Hi, I'm Simon Jones from Writer Centre Norwich, back with a discussion between Abir Mukherjee, A.A. Dand and Michelle Davies, during which they reveal the secrets behind finding inspiration, planning and writing a debut novel, getting an agent, and how they got their big break. This was recorded at the Noirage Crime Writing Festival in 2016. Tickets for the 2017 festival are now on sale from noirage.co.uk. That's noirwich.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Sarah Chaffee from the Bookseller Magazine, and thank you all very much for coming along today. It's lovely to see so many faces, and it's lovely to be back at this festival chairing the debuts panel again. So, my three authors that we've got today. First up, on my far left, is Abir Mukherjee, whose debut novel is called A Rising Man. He was born in London but grew up in the west of Scotland, as you'll be able to hear soon. He lives in London with his wife and his two small children, and he worked, I'm told, reluctantly in finance for the last 20 or so years.
Very reluctantly.
Okay, very reluctantly. Next is Michelle Davies, whose book is called Gone Astray. She's been a journalist for 20 years, writing for publications including Elle and Heat, and she used to be editor-at-large for Grazia. She currently writes for a number of women's publications, lives in London. And last but not least is Amit, whose book is Streets of Darkness under the name A.A. Dand. He was raised in Bradford, as you'll be able to tell in a minute, and spent a lot of time seeing the city from behind the counter of a small convenience store. He became a pharmacist working in London, travelling extensively before returning to Bradford, where he began writing. So welcome all of you. First question, and we'll start with you at the end, Abir, and work our way this way.
I was hoping you were going to do it the other way, give me some time.
Well, you should need hopefully lots of time for this one, because it should be fairly easy. But describe the plot of your novel in one sentence.
Englishman goes out to India to solve crimes and finds out that things aren't quite what he expects. And really it's an introduction to colonial times in India, basically.
Yep. I think that was one sentence. Michelle?
Okay, mine's about the disappearance of a teenage girl whose parents happen to be Euro Millions winners, and it's told, the police investigation is told through the eyes of the family liaison officer.
Okay, and Amit?
Gosh. So suspended from duty, Officer Harry Verdi has 10 hours to save his job, his city, and ultimately his life.
As you do. It puts my to-do list in pales in comparison. Okay, so for all of you, and we'll work this way down this time, where did the inspiration to write fiction come from?
For me, it came from growing up in a convenience store and watching crime thrillers, which were way outside of my age bracket when my parents weren't there. So I watched Silence of the Lambs when I was 12, disturbed me no end. My parents didn't know that I did this, but after watching that movie, I went into my mum's room and confessed what I'd done because I was so terrified. Slept in her bed for the following week, got the world's worst telling off, and thought later on in life, I think I'd like to do that.
Michelle, what about you?
Well, quick answer. I mean, writing about celebrities for a living, which is kind of what I do in magazines, some might say that, you know, a lot of that is fiction. But I just wanted to write from when I was... We were told earlier not to say this as an answer, that we shouldn't say that we wanted to write from when we were young, but I did. I was the same. I wanted to write from about the age of 12, and I became a journalist, did it that way, joined my local paper as a trainee reporter. So, but even though I did showbiz and entertainment journalism, I always wanted to write crime ever since I was little. You know, Enid Blyton, Secret Seven, start on that, and then, you know, there was never a question of me writing anything other than crime.
Okay.
Mine was out of anger, to be honest. I was trying to read the fifth book by an American author, a very famous American author, and I just got really, really angry at how bad it was.
Who's the author?
Can I say? Am I allowed?
It's up to you.
Should we have a guess? Who do you think it is? It's a fifth or sixth book by a very famous American author that's really bad, and each one gets worse. but we still all buy them.
Can of worms.
No, I'm not going to say it. I will say Inferno by Dan Brown. Has anybody tried that?
Yeah.
So I was reading that, and what I'd always, like Michelle, I'd always wanted to write, but what always put me off was I thought, I can't write as well as the stuff that I read. And then I read this and I thought, hang on, this guy's a millionaire. I should at least try. And that's really what got me started. And then being lazy, I gave up after about 10,000 words. And then the second bit of luck was I saw Lee Child on the TV, who said at the age of 39, he started writing. I'd never read any of his work, and I picked up his first book, and it just the plot was just so tight and it was so interesting. And I thought, well, I really should give it a go. Combination of luck and anger, I suppose.
And have you, your debut novels, are they the first books you've written, or have you got things in drawers or a memory stick somewhere hidden away that kind of might come back one day or that should never see the light of day, Michelle?
Yes. Yes. Before I started Gone Astray, I was working on another novel, and I showed it to someone, actually on the recommendation of Sophie Hannah, her old editor, and they just said, they're really good feedback, but they were just like, it's not working. So that's in the bottom drawer. But I have used a character from it for my second book, which comes out next year. So it wasn't completely wasted, but yes, there is one there.
Okay. Amit?
Yeah, I've detailed it quite a lot on my blog. I was at 1.1 million unsuccessful words from 2006. So I started Streets of Darkness in 2006, but it was really terrible, and it was still terrible in 2007, it was still terrible in 2008. By 2010, I don't even know what it was. It was sort of semi-love story, semi-alcoholic police officer, it was just a complete mess. And my agent at the time said, you've murdered it, go away and write something else, which was heartbreaking. And I did, I went and wrote another book called Fields of Blood, gave that to the agent, and she said, I don't like it. So I left the agent. it sounds straightforward, it wasn't. It was the most difficult decision I ever made. But I just didn't believe her. So I left, and I got another agent, and he loved Wheels of Blood, so it was the right decision. And in the meantime, I went back to this story with my first agent's words in my head, which is, you can't possibly control the story, because it's three stories in 10 hours, which all converge at the end to Armageddon. And I thought, well, I quite fancy having a go at it, and redid it. But I've got a counter on my wall, and it was at 1.1 million. It's now probably at about 1.9 million. But a lot of words to finally get there. But it was worth it. It was worth it. Yeah.
And Abbott?
This is where I feel like a bit of a fraud. Because
you are a fraud.
I am a fraud. Amit and I have had this conversation. I'd never written anything before I started writing this book. Because I'm an accountant by day, and numbers are far more important than words, but I got bored of my day job and I felt I had to write, so I started. And then I saw this competition in the Daily Telegraph looking for new crime writers, and you just needed to hand in the first 5,000 words of a novel and a two-page synopsis. And I'd already had 10,000 by that point, so I thought, this is the sort of competition for me, because I don't need to do anything. So I handed it in, and for about 2 days I had these delusions that I was going to be the next J.K. Rowling, and then realised very quickly that that wasn't going to happen, and then forgot about it. And then 3 months later I get an email from the editor who was running the competition saying I'd won. And I fell off my chair and I swore a lot, as Glaswegians do when they're happy. And then I got a call from an agent who was one of the judges, who said, I really like your work, I want to represent you, and I want to represent your book. But I didn't have a book. I had about 20,000 words that didn't fit together. And so I went to see him, and I got to his office, and Hanif Qureshi was standing in reception in his jogging trousers, carrying a Tesco bag, complaining about the price of orchids. And I thought, right, this is a very surreal week. And that was just the beginning of the journey. But I'd not written anything. I'd written, like a lot of people, I'd started and I'd written about a chapter or something and then put it in a drawer and left it. I'm partly fraud, but I'm also, I'd like to think, that if I can do it, anyone can do it. And hopefully that's, inspiration for somebody out there.
So let's talk about the novels themselves. So, Abby, we'll start with you again. Where did kind of the, where was the initial kernel for you? Was it in a character? Was it in the setting? Was it in, was there a, you know, did you imagine the crime? What kind of came first?
Well, for me, it was really, I wanted to tell a story about a period in time that I think we have forgotten. I mean, what occurred to me was that at school I learnt more about German history in the 1920s and 30s than I did about British history or British colonial history. And we either look at that period through, you know, rose-tinted specs, or we brush it under the carpet. And I really wanted to see, well, what is the truth of that period? And I think when you grow up as an ethnic minority in this country, one of the things that it does give you is it gives you this duality whereby you always see things from two perspectives. You never take anything for granted. And that duality sort of, I hope, comes into the book. Because the book is told essentially from, you know, it's from the viewpoint of an Englishman who goes out to India after the First World War, but he's very much a fish out of water. But he teams up with an Indian sergeant called Surendranath Banerjee. His real name is Surendranath, but no one can pronounce that, so they call him Surendranath. And so hopefully what I'm trying to do there is basically look at this period, which I think is a really fascinating period, because it's sort of, It's coloured and it's given rise to the Britain we have today, but also to India as well. And what really fascinates me is the fact that at that period in time, you know, there was a lot of violence, there were a lot of problems, but at the end of the day, these two cultures played out this freedom struggle relatively peacefully in a way that had never been done before. At a time when, you know, in Europe there was fascism and there was communism, where any sort of dissent was met with a bullet or you know, straight to a concentration camp. So how was it in that global atmosphere these two cultures played out this relatively peaceful and civilized struggle? And that's really what I want to try and understand. I haven't done it yet, but that's where I'd like to get through.
Michelle?
I'm trying to think. Mine sort of all came together bit by bit, and I can't quite remember what order it is. I do remember I wrote one chapter with a mother who had come home and her child wasn't where she thought it was. And I think, because I started writing the book when I was on maternity leave, like my hormones were all over the place. And I remember just thinking, you know, what would you do if, because you, especially when they're little, you sort of expect them to be where you left them. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of just, because as a journalist, I read the news all the time, so I often keep clippings of things, stories that I think, oh, that's really interesting, and you know that might work for something or a feature. And so I had this chapter, but it was kind of going to be a flashback, and then so it would be what happened like 20 years later. And then just by chance, which is sort of quite interesting because it's come up again this week, I interviewed Kerry Needham, who obviously I'm sure you've all heard in the news this week. And the reason I was interviewing her was because it was the fifth anniversary of Madeleine McCann going missing. So a women's magazine had asked me to go and speak to Kerry. And at the time, so that was the fifth, so it must be, she had just had her family liaison officer assigned to her. Mm-hmm. So for the first sort of 15 years of Ben going missing, really? Her and her family were doing everything pretty much themselves. They had a contact at South Yorkshire Police, but they were organising all the trips to Greece. And because of what happened with Stephen Lawrence and the inquiry into them, and the Met Police were forced after that. I don't know if you're aware that when they had the McPherson inquiry into the Stephen Lawrence murder case, one of the recommendations was that the Met had to go away and look at family liaison because it was woeful. And Stephen's family really suffered because they didn't have adequate liaison looking after them. So because of that, cases like Kerry's, they finally got someone as a contact. So and just talking to her about, you know, what it's like when your child doesn't come home. And that sort of, that was the trigger. And then the final thing, which came last, was the EuroMillions, because I suddenly thought, well, you know, what's really interesting for me when I read stories and read news stories is really ordinary families who find themselves in really extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, winning £15 million overnight, I can't think of anything more extraordinary. So, and that's, it all came together. But it was like 2 years of, yeah. All right, that works, and then it all came together.
Okay, interesting. And Amit?
So I wanted to write a story which had pace, passion and power in it. those are my three key things that I like to write about. I knew I wanted to set it in Bradford, and I knew that my character was going to be an Asian detective, because we've never seen that in crime fiction. But he was going to be British English, which is what how I classify myself. And I wanted him to be at the forefront of the thriller, not in the background. You know, I get frustrated with Asians in media portrayed as corner shop keepers, of which I am, or pharmacists, of which I am. doctor's account, you know, the usual sort of things. And I thought it was about time that we had someone fierce and formidable on screen. And I'm also really, I'm quite politically incorrect. I don't like the nonsense of being, of having to watch what you say sometimes, especially when you're brought up in the 90s, early 2000s, and now you can't seem to say anything. And I knew my character was going to be able to do whatever he wanted, however he wanted, without being worried about it. So, you know, the pace comes from the 10-hour window of real tension. The passion comes from he's in an interfaith marriage. He's a secular Sikh married to a Muslim woman, and they're both ostracized from their families. I wanted to write about that because it irritates me when Asian people scream about racism, but they never look at themselves. And actually, when they look at themselves, they think it's very easy to say so-and-so is racist, but they themselves, if their children go into a cross-cultural relationship, they become racist, but they don't see that. So I've put that in there. And the power comes from this incredible power struggle in Bradford, which was the richest city in Europe 100 years ago and is now one of the poorest. So you have these three key elements, and I just wanted to put it all into an explosive thriller.
Okay, so carrying on from that and talking about Harry, so all of your characters are, all of your protagonists are obviously the quote-unquote heroes of the novels, but they've also got a lot of faults. So was that key to you to have somebody that was flawed in that way? I mean, if we can start with you, because Harry isn't the nicest person at times.
No, I mean, he's got some darkness in him, but what I like is I think everybody has something that they don't like other people to know. It's a human nature to have parts of us that we're not that comfortable with other people seeing, or secrets that we don't want other people to know. I think it's inherent in all human beings. And for Harry, he needs the darkness as his driving force. So because he's an interfaith marriage, and because he's got issues with race and power and religion, he uses it as a driving force, not something to hold him back, which is what I enjoy about him. But I think, yeah, he's a dark character, but I think it's just highlighting the darkness that every one of us has a little bit of it.
And Michelle, what about you? Because Maggie's got something in her past that she's hiding.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a conscious decision to give her a secret past, but I think that, yeah, as you were saying, everyone has something in them that they don't necessarily want to share, a weakness, and she's... Obviously, the reason she became a family liaison officer is it suits her personality. Mm-hmm. She, you know, she's got patience, so much more patience than I would ever have. You know, and she's really good at empathising with people who, you know, if you need a family liaison officer, then, you know, your family is going through the most horrific, unimaginable ordeal, because that's why family liaison officers are brought in. But, you know, it makes her a people pleaser, mm-hmm. in a way, and that's her weakness. So... But yeah, I didn't sort of sit down and think, right, she has to have a flaw. It sort of evolved as the book was as I was writing it.
Mm. And Abby, your kind of lead detective has just come out of fighting in the First World War, so he's obviously got some demons of his own.
Yeah, Sam Wyndham, the lead character, he's damaged from the First World War. He's also lost his wife. He's grief stricken and he's shell shocked, and he has survivor's guilt. I wanted to set Sam in that period because I see Sam as almost the first of a generation of modern men who were willing to question society. And I think, you know, the First World War had a great impact on a lot of people. They, you know, the certainties that they took for granted disappeared through their experiences in the First World War, and they were much more cynical and much more open to question what they were told. And I wanted Sam to have that characteristic so that when he goes to India, he questions everything. He doesn't just accept, you know, the stereotypes and the certainties that the Raj is built upon. I want him to look, you know, beneath that. I want him to look at Indians, and I want him to look at, you know, Anglo-Indians and British people with a set of modern eyes almost. And I think him being damaged allows that to happen.
Michelle, I'll start with you for this one. Is there is there anything of people you know in Maggie, or is there anything of yourself in her character at all?
Yeah, there's definitely aspects of me. I'm not going to say which ones, but yes, there definitely are aspects of me. And if I think in all of my characters, I think, you know, the character of Leslie, who's the mother of the girl that goes missing, there's definitely a lot of me in her. And even to some extent, the person at the heart of it all, I think you just can't help it when you're writing. You do put yourself into the story. I mean, that's me anyway. I don't know. Mm. Do you?
Yeah, I think each character in my book does have certain elements of me. But it's more about meeting people, changing perceptions. I mean, everybody Lucas Dwight in the book is the ex-leader of the BNP who's supposedly done this awful crime that Harry's got to solve. And I employed a member of the BNP in my pharmacy. I didn't know it at the time. It didn't make no difference to me, people's political persuasions, just how I am. But after 2 years, I'm not saying he turned me or I turned him, but he had a bereavement in the family and the first person he called was me. And I just forgot all of the nonsense about what he stood for, and he forgot the hyperbole of what I stood for, and I put that in the book. So all of the interactions in the books are from interactions that I had with people, because every character that you meet in my book you will think one thing of at the start, and by the end of the book you'll damn well think something else of them. And that's what I enjoy, and to do it in a 10-hour window and to never really know by the end of the book who's bad, who's good, who you empathize with, who you hate. I think that's reflective of life, because people are not all good or all bad. Even the most awful people in the world have been good at times, and even some of the decent people in the world have been bad at times, and that's what fascinates me.
Okay. Abby, what about you?
I have essentially two central characters. There's Sam Wyndham and Surrender Not Banerjee, and I think both of them do encapsulate different aspects of my personality. You know, Sam has a lot of, you know, my British side, and Surrender Not encompasses, you know, he has a lot of the Indian culture and that side of my personality as well. And I think, you know, in writing the book, it was a way of trying to make sense of both these two different parts of my personality that you naturally have as a British Asian. And splitting them into two and seeing that, because they both see things from different angles, which is something I was saying earlier, and I think that's reflected in how these two work together. They're very different, but they work together, and they work hopefully quite well together.
One of the other great things about all your novels is that the way you make the world believable is you have a number of characters, like your secondary characters are all really well developed as well. How do you start building that world around kind of your protagonist or your two protagonists, Abby?
It's a good question. I think I actually came at it from the other angle. I actually tried to drop the protagonists into that environment. You know, I mean, if you take the setting for the book, it's, you know, 1920s Calcutta, which was a hotbed of, you know, political strife. The First World War had just ended. The British government had promised an awful lot during the war to India, most of which was being, you know, kicking the can down the road or negated completely in this period. You had the introduction of the Rowlatt Acts, which effectively, you know, allowed the government to lock up anybody for anything they considered seditious. You know, this is after fighting a war in the name of liberty. So you had a powder keg atmosphere, and, you know, the characters that were around at that time, you know, they weren't bad people. You know, wherever they sat on the spectrum, as Amit said, you know, there's no black or white here. You had a lot of British people in India who'd been there for 40, 50 years, who felt it was their home, who felt it was the country that they'd built, and they were very, very scared. At the same time, you had Indians who were across the spectrum. You had people who were conflicted, you know, dealing with the British or working for the British, as Surrender Not does, but considers himself patriotic Indian, but he's conflicted in his day job. And at the other end, you've got people who are, we would class as terrorists, who they would class as freedom fighters, who believe in their cause and are prepared to do very evil acts for a cause. And I think, you know, what I wanted to do is really drop my characters into that bigger atmosphere and to show that, you know, when we look at that period, we see, you know, gin on the veranda or at the Gymkhana or whatever. And for most people, it wasn't like that. That was even for the British, the vast majority of people were middle class or working class out there. They were architects, they were lawyers, they were, you know, accountants and salesmen. And their, you know, their understanding or their experience of empire is very different to the one that we have portrayed to us today. And I really wanted to look at empire and the effects of the empire on a whole cast of characters, because I think empire had a very nasty effect on the people who enforced it, as well as the people who were governed. Because the question that always struck me is, how does a Christian people oppress another race? And, you know, the only way they could do that was by claiming moral superiority. But that moral superiority, they had to convince themselves of that as much as they were convincing the natives. And a lot of people didn't buy it. And you had this great, you know, number of British people out there who had these crises of conscience, which we just don't know about. I mean, for me, the greatest book about empire is probably Burmese Days, written by George Orwell. And he was pilloried for it. But he sort of looks at that and he sees what was the effect on the British who had to implement this system, which at its heart was one of oppression. And how does a Christian people do that? I think I strayed from the question there a little bit.
That's okay. We can come back to some of those points later. What about you? Because you've got, obviously, Maggie is central, but then Leslie and Mac, the parents of the girl who goes missing, they're sort of secondary characters, but just as important. And
I mean, again, it comes down to setting with the character. So my book is set in a town in the south of England, in Buckinghamshire, which is the county I grew up in. Called Mansell, which doesn't actually exist. It's sort of an amalgamation of lots of towns in that area. Like, my hometown is High Wycombe, but I didn't think anyone would ever want to read a crime novel set in High Wycombe, so I thought, right, do you know what?
Is there any crime in High Wycombe?
Oh, there's lots of crime in High Wycombe, but it's most famous for its roundabouts, and I thought that would be quite boring.
Okay.
And also because I'm a massive Ruth Rendell fan, and I love King's Markham, and I love the fact that if you create a fictional town, you have a lot more license where to put things. You don't get people writing to you go, well, actually, that roundabout's not in the right place in your book. So, but the town is very much like the one. Is it like a lot like High Wycombe, how I grew up? So, and after they won the lottery, Leslie and Mac move down 5 miles down the road to a very wealthy village, which is very like South Buckinghamshire, and therefore the people in it are kind of governed by that. So they're used to a small estate, living on a small estate where everyone knows everyone, and now they're in a gated complex. And so the people that live there are very much keep themselves. They don't socialise, and that's part of one of the problems with the police investigation is no one's seen anything. There was a story going back to collecting clippings when the National Lottery started, 20 years ago. The paper I was on, we ran a story about this. A family in Sheffield were like one of the first big winners, and they moved down to a village near us, and they gave an interview. They went back after about 3 months. They bought this massive house because they just were like, no one talks to us, and this is weird. And so it's that. So a lot of the characters are in it are sort of either ones that would be in my hometown or ones that I recognise from, girls that would be bussed into my school from these villages, okay, and their families. So, but it was, I'd say setting drove it more than anything else.
And is it the same for you? Because Bradford is key to your novel.
Yeah, I like to take characters that we hate as soon as we meet them, but then get inside their heads and try and twist your perceptions of them. You know, if I take Bashir, a character in the book who's, you know, he's an Asian taxi driver, doesn't speak much English, doesn't really like English people, can't stand the country. And he's just very bitter and twisted, you know, he bleeds every day. Why does he bleed every day? You take this character at face value, and there are people like this in Bradford, and I want to get inside his head, and I want to talk to him, so I do that through the books. Although, I have met characters like this in Bradford, and I've never met someone that I couldn't turn in terms of getting inside their head and subverting their hyperbole. So, you know, you take this character, and he's one side of Bradford, and then you've got Harry, who's, you know, fiercely patriotic, British English, loves everything about England. You know, his brown skin is not a flag for him. It's just, you know, it's just he's Asian. But there's nothing exciting about that. And you have these two huge opposing characters, and in the middle you have Lucas Dwight, the ex-leader of the BNP, released from prison 4 days ago. Let's put him with Harry. Let's stick them together and see what happens and see who comes out on top and see if by the end of the book, I don't know how you found it, but everyone that's read the book has always said, by the end of the book, they just, because you see the 3D of all these characters, so even someone like Bashir, who's a nasty piece of work, but by the end of the book, you think, I get it, you know, I don't like it, but I get it. And the same with Lucas, by the end of the book, you think, I get it, you know, I might not like it, but I do understand. And Harry, who's kind of the talisman in the middle, who's trying to pull all these strands together and work them all out. And I think it is, it's just trying to take the hyperbole of the times that we live in, so, you know, take the Daily Mail headlines, get inside their heads and say, let's actually see what you're about and then see if it's credible. And, you know, obviously you stick it in a 10-hour window and it's tight and it's a power struggle. I like examining characters who are not easy to try and fathom out. It makes them interesting and it's a nice journey to go on to try and get inside their heads.
Yeah, I definitely felt, I mean, there were characters that I thought I'd hate throughout, that by the end you kind of, yeah, you do get them, you do feel for them, even though you might not ever see yourselves in that position or having those kind of views or whatever.
Yeah, and it's as an author, it's not nice for me to get to the end of the book and think, you know what, I empathise with the son of a bitch. Sorry. I don't like the fact that I do, but the fact that I do shows me that he is three-dimensional. He's not just the terrorist that you see in front of you. He's not just the racist that you see in front of you. And again, it comes down to, you know, in Bradford, I have 300, 400 conversations a day, whether it's in the corner shop or the pharmacy. I've never met a person who might appear to be racist who, after 12 months, 24 months of me knowing them and them knowing me, I couldn't classify them as being racist. It's just a term that I think is bandied around and not helpful. Ignorant, maybe, but racist, I hate you because you're brown, or I hate you because you're black, or I hate you because you're white. Simple, end of story. But ignorance is something completely different. It's I'm afraid of you. And I like to explore that in a crime fiction because A, I don't think it's been done before, and B, it's the times that we live in. We need to get inside these people's heads.
Okay. All of you talked a little bit about this, but I wondered if you could expand on kind of the research that you did and how you approach that research. Are you people that have got kind of characters and plots stuck up on your walls and, you know, mood boards and things like that, or is it all in your head and you're
it's
laughing?
It's all in my head. I mean, I get criticised when I say this. I don't write anything down. I don't make any notes. I do not write 1,000 words every day. I'm not disciplined. I keep everything in my head until my head is so overwhelmingly crowded that I'm afraid I'm going to forget something and then I'll start writing. And I'll write the book in a month, two-week epic sessions. I'll write 35,000 words in a week, and then I'll take 2 weeks off and write the other 35,000, and I won't leave the house, and I won't talk to anyone. But it's just how I do it. It's taken me 10 years to get here.
Yeah.
And I tried the whole be disciplined, it didn't work, make notes, colour, post-it notes, charts. I have got them now because I'm editing, and I use them for editing, but for the first draft, it's literally, I just write chapter one and then whatever comes into my head, I write it. And, you know, it means shelving a lot of words. So
that's why you're on 1.9 million.
I'll probably shelve 30,000 words for every draft that I write.
Wow.
Just because it takes, you have to get through the nonsense and there's always 30,000 words of absolute drivel that you just shelve and then you start to get to the good stuff. And that's just how I do it.
Michelle, what about you? You mentioned kind of keeping cuttings and things like that,
yeah.
Things that have interested you.
I think when I set out to write the book and I decided, right, I want, after meeting Kerry Needham, right, a family liaison officer would be a really good character to explore. I was very lucky to sit down with the head of family liaison for Thames Valley Police. Bit weird, we met in a motorway service station on the M40. I said to my other half, I'm just going to go and meet this guy. He says he's a police officer, so off I toddled. But he was amazing, and he sat down and said, right, this is what the role is. So I had that, I had all the notes for that, and then the rest of it, I wrote it, and then I went back to check if that would happen.
Okay.
Because it's not that you want the truth to get in the way of your plots, but I just thought I had enough about the family liaison that everything else I could sort of build around it. But I started writing the novel when I was on maternity leave, so it took me about 4 years on and off to finish it. And I do binge write, so I'll write for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and then I have to do my day job, which is writing, you know, writing other features, and then I'll go back to it. And then I do my post-its afterwards. So what I do is I'll read it, and then I put the chapters on the wall and do it that way.
Okay.
But with the second book, I the process was a lot different. Mm. It was completely different. Whereas literally making it up as I went along with the second one, I wrote a 5,000 word outline first of where I wanted it to go. Mm. And I didn't stick to it completely. And then I wrote that one in 6 months. So. Mm.
Interesting. And Abbe, what about you? I mean, you said at the beginning that kind of at school in history, you're not really taught about this period of time. So how did you do all the research around that?
Well, being an accountant, my first thing is to plan everything out in an Excel spreadsheet, obviously. Which then gets, you know, it's all very, very colourful, but then it gets thrown out the window and it's a mad dash in the last 3 months to actually write something. But in terms of research, it's basically three sides to it, the way I do it. I mean, one is if there has to be a topic that I want to explore in the book, and I will do my research around that. So, for example, the second book, a lot of that is set in one of the princely states in India. And, you know, even at the height of the Raj, two-fifths of India was still nominally independent, and it was governed by these princes who were extremely wealthy. These people were the sheikhs of their day, you know, the richest men in the world. But a lot of them were debauched, and they were, you know, fat. They were warriors going to sea because they had no power. They couldn't even leave India without the permission of the viceroy. But they liked the finer things in life. And through my research, so I went and got a whole pile of books on the subject. And one of the things that came out very quickly to me was just the role of women in this era. You know, the women, we have a view of, you know, Asian women, be they Muslim or Hindu, as being, you know, almost, you know, repressed in a way, especially at that time where we have, you know, a view of a harem or women behind parda or whatever, and these women weren't allowed out and they were, you know, effectively Maharaja's pleasure palace. And the truth was very, very different. You know, the harem was place of political power, and quite often it was the women who ran these countries, and they not only did they run them, they were keepers of the culture. And something that didn't strike me, we have a view of Muslim women today. If we go back 100 years, there were Muslim women running states in India quite openly. You know, there was a state called Bhopal, which for about 50-60 years had a series of women rulers. And to me, that only came out through research. I knew I wanted to look at this subject, but, you know, the research that, you know, reading the books actually opened a lot of doors and a lot of, you know, knowledge to me. In terms of the day-to-day research, I think Google is your friend. You can find an awful lot out on the internet. And some of it, you know, is just fascinating. I mean, one of the things that I found out, and I don't know if this is true, but it was on Wikipedia, so I assume it's true.
Everything's true on Wikipedia.
Before Hollywood Boulevard became the most expensive, you know, strip of real estate in the world, which I think was about 1900, the place with the most expensive street in the world was in Dundee. It was actually in Broughty Ferry, just outside of Dundee. It was this one street where all these jute merchants would live. And this is because, you know, they all grew fat on the jute trade from Bengal. And Dundee was the, you know, the home of jute in the UK, jute jam and journalism, the three things Dundee was known for. And the most expensive street in the world was in Dundee, which is just, you know, bonkers. And you find these sorts of things out. And the final leg of research was actually having to go to be there on the ground. So I went out to Calcutta three or four times. And sometimes it's the things that you take for granted that you get completely wrong. So I assumed, having watched, you know, years and years of Mum's Bollywood films, that all police uniforms in India are khaki. They are, except for in Calcutta, where they're white. And, you know, so the first two drafts of the book, I had, like, khaki uniforms. And, you know, if that had made it through to the final book, people would have said, you haven't got a clue about the place. But, yeah, even today, the uniforms are still white in Calcutta, and that's a legacy of the colonial period. The other thing was the colour of the earth. You know, I assumed it would be red, like it is in most of India, but the earth, the mud in Calcutta, is black. So it's these wee things that you pick up as much as the big things. And the last thing I'd say is I got invited to the police museum in Calcutta, which was a fascinating place because it charts the history of the police force in Calcutta, going back into colonial times. And the police have a very schizophrenic view of their own history. So, you know, up to independence, they almost concentrate on the freedom struggle. So they look at all of the actions done by civil disobedience people and terrorists as freedom fighters. And then anything that's post-independence that's violent gets labelled terrorism. But everything pre-independence is freedom fighters did this. And it's, you know, this was the body that was, you know, up till 1947, considered a tool of repression by the current, you know, members of the police force. And that's something that I didn't expect. You know, how does an institution like a police force go from one day being one thing and then another day being something completely different? You know, and how does that affect the people who are members of that organisation?
All of your novels are kind of, and again, you've talked a bit about this, are kind of about the conflicts between people, so the haves and have-nots, the rich and poor. Is that something that you think crime novels can explore really well, that kind of tension between different types of people, whether it be different religions or different class of people? Because I think class comes up throughout the novels as well.
I think crime novels can be anything, where they can be anything. They don't necessarily need to be about people or wealth. They can just be about injustice. And I think that, you know, for me, obviously, I took a view of people in there, because Bradford's, you know, quite a rich place for lots of different types of people. And it's more about, you know, getting inside their heads and their struggles. But I think that we do live in a time where there is a huge gap between, there's a huge wealth gap, potentially, which can lead to a huge class gap. And I think that that breeds an area where you can explore, you know, crime and people's frustrations, and I'm one of them. You know, when you see mass wealth, you know, whether it's your Facebook or Google's, but then, you know, Facebook, you know, if they earn 10 billion quid a year, but then they can't protect people from being bullied online, you know, it's just ridiculous. You know, and I think that makes people angry. And the minute you get that anger, you just ask yourself what you want to do about it, and you have your crime. So I think it can be about anything, but it's just about injustice. It doesn't necessarily about people or wealth. And we do, unfortunately, live in a time where there's a huge amount of injustice, and that means that as crime writers, your playground it does no bounds. You know, you can literally, you can take the smallest thing, and you know the crime novels always think about, you always think about murder, and that's interesting, because it's probably, you know, in our minds, it's the worst thing that can happen, is murder. But it's what the murder, it's the effect, cause and effect, and I think that's what's interesting to look at.
I mean, have current events or kind of events when you were writing the book influenced kind of what you wrote about at all?
I mean, I think for me, with the crime novel, I mean, crime always starts with someone wanting something they can't have. So just deciding to take something that's not there. So whether it's another person or whether it's money or something. And you know, it goes back to what I said earlier about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, there is a disparity between sort of rich and poor, and people wanting, you know, aspiring to being famous or being rich and stuff. And that for me was the trigger of, you know, is winning loads of money the best thing in the world? My partner and I, we always have this route. He buys a lottery ticket, I wouldn't buy one, because I said I don't want to win that much money. So this was even before I wrote the book. And then, you know, when I started looking into it and seeing, you know, what often happens to lottery winners, it's lots of them are really miserable, and it's actually the worst thing that ever happens to them. So, but going back to your point, I think that, you know, yeah, I think crime novels can explore that conflict between class. But as Amit was saying, I think, you know, you can do anything with a crime novel. It doesn't have to be necessarily good versus evil, but the injustice of the world that we are in now. But for me, it was very much about that. What people do when they find themselves in a situation that's so extraordinary, they just can't kind of get their heads around it, and how you react to that.
Yeah. And Abby, what about you? Because yours is a historical crime, but do you think there are things that are still relevant in kind of what you're writing about?
I think that there are different traditions of crime fiction. You've got your Agatha Christie, genteel, you know, stately home whodunits, which was, you know, a very English tradition. And then you've got crime novels as social commentary, which I think sort of started maybe in the 60s or the 70s, pioneered by a lot of Scots, people like William McIlvany, who I think, you know, was an absolute genius. But, you know, the people like Ian Rankin and Val McDermid have followed in the footsteps of. And I think social commentary is a very important role for crime fiction. Ian Rankin, in an interview earlier this year, said, you know, a policeman is a very, very good vehicle for examining society because he has an access all areas pass. He deals with prostitutes in the lowest and he deals with politicians in the highest. And so I think it's a great, great vehicle for examining a lot of social issues. And I think a lot of crime writers are actually driven by an urge to examine social issues and, you know, to almost shed light on a lot of issues that are faced by society. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, it's a very worthwhile endeavour, and I think it's very important. To answer your point about, you know, are there any things, when I was writing, was there anything that sort of came to me in terms of, you know, looking at what I was writing and if there was any modern parallels? I think fear. Mm-hmm. I think that we live in an era of fear of outsiders, fear of people who are different. We see that in what's happening with Europe here, and I think there was a lot of fear at the time in India, you know, not just amongst the British, but there was an awful lot of fear amongst them saying, you know, what will happen to this country that we have built? Then you had this whole class of people, Anglo-Indians, who were distinct from Indians and the British. They were, you know, the product of, you know, the mixed marriages 200 years before, which were allowed then, but then, you know, became frowned upon in the 1800s. And you had this whole community who had no idea what would happen to them in the event of independence. And they're probably the most loyal people in the empire because, you know, they had no future. They could envisage no future outside of it. So I think one of the great parallels that I saw during both then and now is this fear of the other, fear of the unknown and fear of the outsider. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that we need to sort of guard against. What I would say is that one of the other things that I was trying to write about was the fact that, you know, this was a period of change and it was a period of uncertainty. And it was the people who were certain about things that are the people that are most often wrong, in my opinion, if that makes any sense. If you're certain about something and you believe it 100%, you're more likely to make mistakes. And I think that's what we do as a people. If we think of ourselves as morally superior, as we did in the 20s, we'll make the same mistakes that we make today, such as going into, you know, the Second Gulf War, thinking that we have a moral obligation, that we are better than these people, therefore we need to do something. And we often do it blindly without thinking through the consequences. And I think that's another parallel from then that I see as repeating today.
Okay. Right, so we're running over slightly, sorry. So we've got time for a few questions. If you can stick your hand up if you've got a question. No? Yeah, if you want to stand up just so we can hear you because we don't have a roving mic.
I'm just really interested in Abir's historical novel. If you were, when you write your second novel, have you got any ideas about where you might set it?
Yes, the second one is underway right now. As I say, it's set in the same period. It's the same two central characters. It starts off in Calcutta, but it goes very quickly to one of the princely states, which did actually exist, but not in the time that I'm writing about it. It was actually taken over by the East India Company in the 1800s under something called the Doctrine of Lapse, which basically allowed the company and then the India office to take over a country or a state if they felt it was badly run or if there was no male heir. And badly run could be, on one occasion they overthrew a Maharaja because they accused him of trying to poison the grapefruit juice of the British ambassador. So yeah, it's a fascinating period and these, there was so much colour to it as well, things that we don't know today, you know. Maharajas filling their swimming pools with champagne to celebrate the birth of a son There's a lot of sexual politics at the time as well, because you had a period where the only people who could really marry white women, being Indians, were these Maharajas, because they were so wealthy. But even then you had class boundaries. So they would come to Britain and they would end up, you know, falling in love with a chiropodist or a taxidermist or a trapeze artist. It wouldn't be the aristocracy. It would be these sort of women whose heads would be turned by this wealth, and suddenly they'd find themselves in a village in the middle of nowhere in a huge palace that may look like Versailles, but with oxen going up and down the road. And so, I mean, it was a really fascinating period, and I had a lot of fun researching it.
Yeah. And Michelle and Amit, do you want to talk quickly about what you're working on at the moment? You don't have to.
No, I've just finished book two. Okay. So it's a continuation of the series, so it's another case with DC Maggie Neville, the family liaison officer. There's two cases. There's an attempted murder-suicide of a married couple, and also a historic case of a mum that went missing. Well, she walked out on her daughter 20 years ago. That's how the two cases are.
Yeah. I'm working on a couple of things at the moment. We sold the film rights for Streets of Darkness quite quickly, and in the meeting with them, my agent had always said, if they ask you if you know how to do something, just say yes. And they said, do you know how to write a TV show? And I said, yeah, of course I do. So they said, great, write one. So I'm doing that at the moment. I'm not the TV show writer. I've got first options on it, first refusal, and they probably will refuse it. But I've got a deadline for that, the 21st of October. And it's just exciting to try my hand at it. I've never written a TV show before, so I'm on a crash course to attempt it. And I'm writing book two, which is due next month as well, which is called Girl Zero, where we look at, we touch on the grooming gangs that have been plaguing us at the moment, but I don't look at it in a conventional way. I want to know what happens when a victim wants more than justice, and I want to know what happens when I throw Harry into the middle in her firing line. And I want to know at what point either of them breaks to either turn each other or kill each other. So it's called Girl Zero, and the tagline is, a city which abandoned her will pay the ultimate price.
Ooh. Okay, any more questions? Yeah, if you can just stand up so everyone can hear you.
So I've got a question about something that goes under the tag of pleasure cultures. We live in times in which many events can go under the tag of pleasure cultures, obviously. And Ken Follett once wrote that pleasure cultures is a terrific drama. So it provides a lot of terrific material for writers. And I was wondering if you could suggest me who are the writers, especially in current fictions, who are taking advantage of this advice the most.
Did everyone hear that?
No.
Okay. So the question was about books that look at clashes of culture, and can our authors recommend any? And are there any books that influence you, any crime novels that kind of you might have read when you were younger that influenced you as well? I'll tag that on the end.
I mean, I think mine is the first clash of cultures, I think, to be written about the way I've written it, which is, you know, the agnostic, agnostic Sikh, who's married to a practicing Muslim woman, set in our times where everyone seems to have an identity crisis. I think I couldn't find any books that talked about that clash of cultures. I couldn't find any books where, the Asian person was put under the spotlight themselves to look in the mirror and say, you might scream the word racism every day of your life, but when you look in the mirror, what are you looking at? You know, can you yourself say that you are not racist? And also looking at that term racism, because it's a word that bugs me, because we see it in the media every day. And like I said, you're only racist if you look at someone and go, I hate you because you're white, I hate you because you're brown, I hate you because you're black, which is not the right term which has been used at the moment. At the moment, it's ignorance or fear of the clash of cultures you talk about. But it's not racism. It's more an identity crisis. But I think people have banned it about. It's not racist to say we don't allow more immigrants into the country. It's a political decision. It has so many different aspects of it, but it just gets tagged under racism. And that bothers me, because I think it's not at all. It's perfectly acceptable to be concerned about the impact of mass migration, whether you're writing about Abia's time, you know, whether it was colonial times in India. The same conversations or struggles were talked about as we talk about now, but now we just want to say it's racist. So I couldn't find any books that talked about it, which is why I wrote it.
I was going to recommend, actually, I know she's sitting in the audience, Ava Dolan's books, yes. Because they're set with the two police officers who are in a hate crimes unit, and they are brilliant.
Yeah.
Indeed, that's why I did read Ava's book, which Sam Peter wrote about sort of immigrants coming in. Yeah. I just wanted to focus on the Asian side of it and go into the Asian politics of looking in the mirror and seeing what you see.
Yeah, I feel a bit bad now because I was stole my thunder. You must read Eva's books. They are brilliant. I mean, Long Way Home is great. And for me, in terms of clash of cultures, just to pick up what Amit said, I don't think there are that many that I found in the crime genre. There's an awful lot of things that you can look at more generally if you go back into the past. For me, though, you know. What really spurred me on was the idea of a good man upholding a bad system or a corrupt system. And there are some very good crime novelists dealing with that. The person I look to most is probably Philip Kerr, who writes the Bernie Gunther novels. Basically, it's a German policeman living in the 30s and 40s under Nazism. And I think his books are fascinating. There's Gorky Park, and Martin Cruz Smith wrote the Arkady Renko novels about a detective in communist Russia, the Soviet Union, and I think that was brilliant as well. And obviously you've got Fatherland, by Philip Harrison, which was just phenomenal. And I think that's started, for me, that's what I find really fascinating, which is how does a good man uphold a system that he doesn't believe in? And there's a conflict in that, and that's, I think, there's a lot of that, hopefully, that, in Sam as well.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question. No? Sorry, I have loads more questions, don't worry. In terms of getting published, what's been the most enjoyable thing about being a published author, and what's been the most scary or the worst thing, Michelle?
The best thing, I think, is when you get the book in your hands, when they send you the first copies. Because you're writing it, and it's amazing when you get your agent and you get your publishing deal, but even then it's not tangible until you're actually holding it in your hands. Mm-hmm. I think the scary thing for me is things like this, because as a journalist, I'm used to interviewing other people. Excellent. I'm used to asking the questions, and suddenly being asked to talk about myself, I find that quite strange. So, but it's been amazing. It's been a wonderful ride so far.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is the best thing.
Sorry, I should have said that. This is the best thing.
I don't know. You know what? There's been so many things. And, I never expected... I mean, I didn't start writing until about 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, and I never expected any of this. And to be honest, I pinch myself sometimes because I'm so blasé about it. I've got no benchmark for any of it, whether it's, picking up the first copy of the book, as you say, or the first time you see a review, or the first time one of... your idols sort of says something in a paper about your book, and you just think, you fall off your chair at that point. You just think this is just mental. So many things that happen, and they're all firsts. For me, there's a fear that what happens with book two, it's like, how do you replicate this? And what if you can't replicate it? What if people just think it's rubbish? every time I start feeling good about myself, I'm a writer. I can say I'm a writer. I then go home and my wife shouts at me. I think in terms of the downside, it's just time because, I've got a wife and two kids. I have to do a day job because my kids need shoes, it's fitting. That's true. If you've got any sort of shoes that your kids have grown out of, walking. But I think it's finding the time, of writing to deadlines and doing a day job and raising a family. It's just, it's great, and I think we must be slightly mad to do it, but it's great. It's great fun, and I just feel incredibly, blessed and honoured to have been, given a chance to do it.
Amit, what about you, best and worst thing?
I think the best thing was fooling my publisher with my twist, because we sent it to Bill Scott Kerr, who publishes Dan Brown, Lee Child. I know Abir hates Dan Brown. I'm a fan of his storytelling, yeah. Maybe not his writing style.
I don't hate him, I like admire him. I mean, the man's made a lot of money.
But I was nervous.
I'm an accountant, I respect that. Smarter than me.
I wanted him as a publisher, and I was really worried that he'd read a lot of books, but I'd worked really hard on my twist at the end of the book. It was 10 years in the making, and he didn't see it, so I was really thrilled at that. And I think the worst thing, he probably won't thank me for saying this, but is the agenting process of, I had a lot of pain with, sort of going through that process and, deciding to who to go with, when to leave, when to back yourself was difficult. So but it makes you a stronger person, I think. I think ultimately there will be times when you have to ask yourself, are you willing to back yourself and when difficult decisions have to be made? And if the variables all match and you think that you're right and you're ticking all the boxes that you believe need to be ticked, sometimes you'll have to back yourself.
Great, and that's a great note to end on. I think we've run over very slightly. If you can just give the panel a round of applause, it's Abin, which is going to be
Thanks for listening. Please do subscribe to the podcast, and if you want to find out more about our work, head over to writerscentrenorwich.org.uk.